Okay, it's my pleasure now to introduce the next session, Regulatory Update on Risk Culture. We have titled this session Risk Culture, but as I think you probably gathered, it's a bit fluid, the boundaries between risk culture and conduct risk, and I think we'll probably have a little bit of overlap in this session as well. But we are changing gear. We've heard from industry, we've heard from a representative of one of the APRA regulated banks and a consultant. Now we're hearing from the two lead financial regulators, I suppose. And we talked about the Twin Peaks model of financial regulation. So we're very fortunate to have a representative both from APRA and ASIC to speak to us today. Both regulators have increased their focus on risk culture recently. APRA issued their information paper late last year on risk culture, outlining their plans to step up supervision of risk culture. And obviously preceding that, the introduction of CPS 220 that cut across industries, across banks and insurers, spelt out the expectation for regulated institutions' boards to form a view on the culture within their organisations and to drive change if they thought it was inadequate. ASIC, likewise, is also very interested in governance, conduct and culture, with a particular focus on organisations undergoing change either through technology or from regulations or from new regulations. So this update is therefore very timely and relevant for all organisations enhancing their error and response plans. And I understand Fahmy will also give us an update on APRA's pilot reviews on risk culture. Same format as before, we'll have both speakers give their presentations and then we'll have time for Q&A. So firstly, I'd like to introduce Fahmy Hussain. Fahmy was appointed as APRA's Head of Governance, Culture and Remuneration in August 2015. He's responsible for leading the development of APRA's thinking, supervisory practices and industry engagement on these interrelated topics. His career at APRA spans over 16 years, primarily in the role of frontline supervisor. He's been responsible for leading teams that have supervised entities across banking, general insurance, life insurance and superannuation. Between 2012 and 2014, Fahmy moved to a policy development role where he led the team that created APRA's cross-industry risk management standard, CPS 220, as well as APRA's conglomerate supervision framework. He's a member of the Financial Stability Board's Working Group on Governance Frameworks and has assisted the IMF as a technical expert on conglomerate supervision, which has involved participating in missions to advise foreign governments on the development of their frameworks. Please join me in welcoming Fahmy.
Thank you, and hi everyone. I had to do this, but a few disclaimers up front. I won't be discussing any individual institutions today. I'll be talking about broadly our risk culture pilot review exercise, but it does strike me that most of you in the audience today are probably better than most predicting things of the future. And it strikes me that timing to talk about risk culture is really apt right now. The Institute asked me to talk about risk culture about 6 months ago in March, which was really great timing from APRA's perspective, given we had released a information paper on risk culture six months prior to that, which really was a good starting point from an APRA perspective to communicate what it is we are doing in risk culture and what are some of the key issues in that space. I'm not going to go over that conversation today. What I'd like to do today is actually talk you through some of the detail of our risk culture pilot reviews. We are now at a point where we can communicate publicly around the methodology that we've arrived at. This is exciting times for us as it's taken us great deal of time and effort to arrive at this point. So hopefully you'll take away something new today from us and hopefully a better understanding of what exactly APRA is doing in the risk culture space. But I thought I'd start with just a recap, a very brief recap on what's preceded us. And so in 2015, we created this standalone governance, culture and remuneration risk specialist team within APRA. The idea there was that we wanted to bring together a dedicated capability to think about culture, remuneration and governance all together in the one unit. And so the first 18 months or so, there were a number of us really focused on research and industry engagement around these topics, and in particular risk culture as a focus. So we spent that time engaging with industry, with consultants, with academics and regulators around the world to really get a better sense of risk culture. What is it? What makes sense for a prudential regulator perspective to look at and think about? That culminated in the publication of our information paper in October of last year. Hopefully you've read that, and I'm going to take that as read, as I won't go into a lot of the detail today on that. But since that time, we've been extensively pursuing a methodology around how is it that APRA should go about assessing the risk culture of a financial institution that we regulate. And we've landed on a methodology that we're actually now trialing. And we're doing a number of pilot reviews over the coming year to really test our methodology in terms of where we think it makes sense for a prudential regulator to look at. And what you'll see as I talk you through the slides today is that there are many important differences to our APRA's existing supervisory framework and approach to reflect what we think is required to better understand the culture of financial institutions. So at a big picture level, what are the pilot reviews looking at? We've outlined some very clear expectations in CPS 220, our cross-industry risk management prudential standard. And really the key point is we're expecting boards to form a view of the risk culture of their organisation. That's pretty simple, but actually there are some important sub-points to that which are inherent in terms of that paragraph in the CPS 220, and they're around understanding, the board actually understanding the extent to which risk culture is supporting or perhaps detracting away from their risk culture. They're able to identify any desirable changes and actually affect change in that direction. And so if you look down to this bigger chart here, this is a nice high-level diagram in terms of exactly what it is we're trying to do. And the language here, I think, is important to note. It's actually quite different to what you would typically hear from APRA in this space, but it's important recognition of where we're travelling to in terms of risk culture conversations. And so what we're really trying to answer is, does the institution demonstrate a sound risk culture? So the central point here is behavioural norms. This is what we're really focused on when we're trying to do these pilot reviews, and that is, to what extent behavioural norms reinforce effective risk management? What does that actually mean? Well, there are a number of boxes here that hopefully help you understand this. We want to understand that the outcomes that demonstrate effective risk management, they come in all sorts of forms. Perhaps some we've seen recently over the last couple of years, some perhaps poorer incidents that have arisen. That's an outcome of something. What was that an outcome of? Was it behavioural norms that perhaps drove those type of outcomes? But importantly, and this is a critical element of our review framework, is the bottom two boxes. What we're looking here at both formal and informal drivers of behavioural norms. And I think traditionally what you would expect to see from most regulators here and overseas is a real focus on formal drivers. If you look at all of our prudential standards, all of our prudential practice guides, a lot of it is chock full of really strongly worded requirements and recommendations around formal drivers, like policies, procedures, governance frameworks, architecture, right? And they are absolutely important and vital for really sound risk management, but they're not the only things. And we've learnt this through research, through understanding actual outcomes of, say, the GFC, for instance, but actually informal drivers are just as important. And this is a space which is pretty new for APRA in terms of getting into it in a really dedicated, focused sort of way. And we're keen, as part of this pilot review, is to really try and encapsulate those informal drivers that are contributing towards the behavioural norms. And in fact, often you can find institutions that have, on paper, really fantastic formal elements to their risk management framework or to their governance framework. It looks great on paper. The effectiveness of it actually comes down to the informal drivers. What are the behavioural norms that are supporting or detracting from the quality of those documents? And so it's just some commentary around the side of this diagram. Some of the things we're trying to walk away from a pilot review, and that is, does the senior leadership and board have an accurate view of the risk culture of the institution? And so by doing these pilot reviews, what we're trying to do is establish for ourselves our own view of the risk culture and then ultimately see, does that align to what the board and senior management are thinking? And also, we're trying to get a sense that the board and senior management are able to actually identify areas of change or weakness that's required in the risk culture space. And that requires a degree of self-reflection, self-awareness, and understanding the topic of culture in itself. So let's move on. And the first couple of slides are actually quite theoretical, conceptual in nature. The last slide I'll talk about is actually very practical. So hopefully some of this is not making a lot of sense to you. You'll get a better sense of the connectivity with the practical application of this on the last slide. So we've set out a number of key principles that are going to guide us through these pilot reviews, and this is really important for us. And one of the things that is often talked about when it comes to culture is it's soft and fluffy, you can't measure it, it's hard to really understand. That's not our view. Our view is you can actually assess it, you can measure it, you can think about it in a quantifiable sense. The thing is, the sort of quantitative metrics and things you're looking at are actually not financial typically, they're behavioural. It's the same, it is data, it's just a different type of data. For APRA, you know, we're a regulator based on skill sets of economists, lawyers, accountants, actuaries, but what we don't have a great deal of skill set in is behavioural, human behaviour. Well, we've started to get that into the organisation, certainly into the GCR team, the governance, culture, and remuneration team. We started to bring in that capability, and that's enabling us to actually think about data in a different way when it comes to human behaviour. So if we just quickly go through some of the key principles of our approach, we want it to be evidence-based, independent, and objective. Evidence-based is critical. We want to get away from this notion of it's soft, you can't really touch, you can't really measure it. It is going to be based on evidence. And you'll see as I go through the following slides where we're going to get this evidence from. But ultimately, what we're trying to do in these reviews is capture as much data as we can from a very wide variety of sources. Ultimately, and you probably heard this term before when it comes to culture assessment, that is triangulation. What you're trying to do is not focus on one source of information when it comes to culture, but many. And what you're looking for are the overlaps. So if you do a survey, for instance, that would be just one mechanism to try and get a sense of culture. From our perspective, you cannot rely on only one. You actually have to have multiple mechanisms and channels through which you're gauging culture. So for us, we would look at surveys, we would look at interview information that we get back, we would look at risk reports, actual outcomes, a whole variety of sources through which we will try and triangulate the common overlaps. And it's in that overlap that we think that's where the actual truth lies when it comes to a culture of an organisation. Number two, systematic and consistent. We want to be able to replicate this process at a number of institutions to provide rigour to a methodology. So ultimately, over time, hopefully we can compare and contrast with what we're seeing. And so the methodology we've come up with, we think we were able to adapt to different types of situations, large, small institutions, different industries, different types of issues as well. Outcome focused. We are really focused on risk management here. And that's it's an important point to make because, as you may have heard already this morning, certainly our view is conduct is one potential outcome of poor risk management. It's not the only one. You could have an institution that actually has very low conduct risk, but actually we might still be concerned about their risk management ability. It could be threatening their future financial viability going forward if they're actually making poor risk decisions but still meeting all regulatory requirements. That would still be a concern for us. Four, we'll be focused on root causes of the organisational system. And that's a really important point. So what we're trying to get to and unwrap here is what are the core drivers getting the sorts of behavioural norms and ultimately the outcomes that you're seeing at an institution? We think it's only once you get to those root causes you can really address the issues at play and hopefully look to try and influence change for the better. But unless you do that, everything will be surface level. So to give you a practical example, as a frontline supervisor, when I used to supervise institutions, often I would come across issues where I would say, there's a problem here in credit risk management. We would ultimately land on saying to the institution, strengthen your credit risk management policy, make that clearer. But ultimately, what we did know is that there was something cultural at play in terms of what was driving the outcome for that, perhaps that credit risk management policy to be weak. And so when we asked for that change to be made, it was made, but actually it would come up in another permeation of that same sort of issue in a different policy. And so ultimately we had these band-aid fixes of change this policy, change that procedure, but there was something more root cause that was driving that type of outcome. And these reviews are aimed to try and get us to that root cause so we can address that issue rather than the outcome. And finally, constructive and realistic. We will be focusing on positive and negative elements of risk culture. There will be things that I'm sure we're going to come across where we will say, some of these behaviours are positively impacting your risk culture, and that's a positive thing, a good thing, and needs to be recognised as well. So let's move on. What are some of the key topics we're going to be looking at? I think this is a really important point. So the ones that are often spoken about are the ones in the light blue. Time from the top, effective communication and challenge, accountability and incentives. And absolutely, we agree that they're some really important areas to look at. And they're the ones the FSB also articulates as the key things to be looking at. But our view is there are also a number of other elements as well, and these are the things that we work into our pilot reviews. So things such as tone from the middle. I think often you hear about this notion of the permafrost of middle management in terms of what's getting through and what they're saying to their staff. Well, that's an important point to think about the cultural tone of an organisation. We're trying to get a sense of that. Just some other bits I'd call out. Values, I think it was spoken about in the last session. It's also another important barometer or a touch point in terms of the type of culture an organisation has. Are they serious about their values? How does that flow through the organisation? An important one is risk competence. So you can often have a notion of a very high staff engagement level, say, at an organisation, which is great. But sometimes some institutions translate that into, therefore, we have a very strong risk culture or a very good culture. I would say from an engagement perspective, that is great. But from a financial institution perspective, what we are also expecting is risk competence. You need to be risk competent to be a well-run organization and to actually establish and maintain a sound risk culture. So this is another element that we're looking into here. It's all well and good that the people are wanting to do the right thing, but what if they don't have the competence or the actual underlying training, qualifications or whatever to get you to that risk competence bit? So the point of this slide is just to tell you that there are more than those four core attributes that you might want to think about when it comes to culture. We're certainly looking at a whole variety of different types of elements in our pilot reviews. So this is the last slide, and this is where hopefully you'll get to see some practicalities here. And for those of you who have dealt with APRA from a regulated institution perspective, a lot of this will make sense to you, but some of it will be very new to you. And I want to explain some of those new parts to you. So for those who don't deal with APRA on an ongoing supervisory basis, often a key part of our supervisory approach is to conduct on-site reviews. We deep dive into credit risk, insurance risk, treasury areas, the whole gamut of risk areas for a financial institution we will go into. From a risk culture perspective, this is the layout of the review that we're actually doing right now in terms of trying to undertake an on-site review to get us the data we're looking for. Some key points I would call out here. So survey is a reference point here. Typically for an APRA on-site review, there is no survey, but for risk culture pilot reviews, we will be deploying surveys. We've created the survey ourselves, but utilizing a third party to access staff and to collect that information. That's just one of our data collection points. What we're also doing, and again, this is new from an APRA on-site supervisory perspective, is we're conducting one-on-one interviews across an organization. So typically when APRA does an on-site review, a review will look like talking to very senior management or the board on a certain topic. Whether it's insurance risk, credit risk, we will talk to the credit risk managers, we will talk to the head of the business lines, and that's generally it, and we walk away with a view. What we're doing as part of the pilot reviews, we're talking to a whole range of staff all the way down to the most junior levels and frontline people that typically we haven't done before. What this enables us to do is get another source of data in terms of the type of culture that is being at least perceived by these individuals through an interview process. What we also do are focus groups. That enables us to get a whole range of people, typically at the same sort of level, within the same sort of team, in at one time to get a better sense of what they're thinking as well. And again, it's another data point for us. Another interesting point under fieldwork is in situ observations. We'll be sitting in on board meetings to observe them in practice. We're doing the same of executive committees as well. And this is a really critical point here. What we've noticed is for a lot of cultural assessment methodologies out there from a private sector perspective or a consulting perspective, is that from our perspective, we think the board and executive committee is absolutely critical. They themselves, as a construct of cultural influence, we think is huge. So as part of our pilot reviews, we incorporate analysis of the board in terms of their culture, analysis of the executive committee. How are their behaviours? How do they interact with each other? What sort of signals are they actually inadvertently or actually consciously providing down the organisation, which is affecting culture across an organisation? So they're two key barometers for us, the board and executive committees, when we do our pilot on-site reviews. And another interesting change for us is the timing. So to conduct a whole range of interviews, focus groups, in situ observations takes some time. So you might be familiar, for those of you who deal with APRA, an on-site review might go as long as 1 week at a large institution. For some of these reviews, we'll be on-site for maybe 3 weeks, could be longer. But remembering, we're not doing meetings where you have a whole range of executives on one side of the table and APRA on the other. One-on-one, these are one-on-one interviews. That's what's going to take up the time. So our footprint on an organisation is actually much bigger from an on-site review perspective when it comes to risk culture. The feedback session is really important. So this is where we have put everything together, tried to triangulate all the data, come up with the common themes, and go back to the board and executive committee to be able to say, this is what we've seen. And by the way, this isn't the view of APRA. This is what your organisation has told us. Everything that we will reflect back in those conversations is about what we have seen, what we have heard, what we have put together. We haven't come up with this. It's simply a reflection of what your organisation has told us. We think that's quite powerful in terms of being able to reflect back to an institution to say, this isn't about APRA coming in with some perhaps already set views in terms of your organisation. This is about what we've collected from you. And this is what your people are telling us. And so that's hopefully a good sense of the review process. We're in a pilot review phase. So next year, and towards the middle of next year, we are planning to build this into normal business as usual type of practice. And so in terms of our ongoing supervisory practice with existing institutions, we'll look to try and deploy elements of this as part of ongoing supervision. But when it comes to a dedicated on-site review, really focused on risk culture, the governance, culture and remuneration team will be leading that type of review where we've built this type of methodology to deploy. I want to leave it there and hand over if I could. Yep, great, thank you.
Thank you, Fahmy. That's been a great insight into what you're doing and what your plans are with these pilot reviews. So, as I mentioned, same format, we'll get Greg up to speak and then we'll take questions for both speakers. So our next speaker is Greg Yanko. He's held the position of Senior Executive Leader of Market Supervision at the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, or ASIC, since 2008. The Market Supervision Team has responsibility for market surveillance and monitoring market conduct to ensure participants and investment banks comply with their regulatory requirements. Greg served as New South Wales Regional Commissioner for ASIC from 2008 to 2012 and has led some of ASIC's largest programs, including the transfer of market supervision from the ASX to ASIC and the implementation of ASIC's new integrated market surveillance system. He also played a major role in the introduction of market competition in Australia. Greg sits on ASIC's Digital Governance Board and the Markets Advisory Panel, is Deputy Chair of the International Organisation of Securities Commissions Committee 3, and is an active member of the Intermarket Surveillance Group. Greg is a former Chief Executive Officer of ACCN, is that?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. a joint venture formed to provide an alternative venue to trade Australian listed securities. Prior to this, he was at the ASX for about 20 years, where he managed diversified teams within the regulatory and commercial environments covering market structure and product management, client relations, market surveillance and broker compliance. Please join me in welcoming Greg.
Thanks, and yes, I only work for companies that start with the letter A, including a bank once. So, and they did hassle you to open accounts a lot, right? Even then, that was an awful long time ago. So thanks, Brett and Fahmy, and thanks for having me here today. Mine's a little bit more traditional than that. I think this is a bit. So how far have I gone? I've gone too far. Right? So look, I think ASIC's interest in conduct and culture is very similar to APRA's, and but with a different slant, because you know, of course, APRA is about financial stability, and we're about confident and informed investors and trust as well as with APRA, trust and confidence in the financial system. So we want to make sure customers and investors are treated fairly. We want to make sure, and I think this is something that we haven't had a whole, we've seen some examples of not getting the right outcome, is financial products performing in the way customers and investors have been led to believe they will. So last week we published our corporate plan, and in that it sets out our roadmap for the future about strengthening our capabilities, responding to long-term challenges and achieving our vision. And one of those things that is a priority and a challenge is to make sure that conduct supports investor confidence. However, across our industry, we've seen examples of poor culture, and we're not alone, and that was where, sorry, you've already got the Wells Fargo example. Now, this is a good example, but it's just appalling, right? So these, they had what was called the Customer Incentive Program, and it was called We're Going for Great, and that meant opening 8 accounts for every customer. And so there was incentives to do this. And what we ended up finding was, is that they've opened 2 million accounts. I don't know how many customers, divide that by 8, you know how many customers are involved. And people were really hassled into doing this. And so what it meant was we opened up all these accounts, and then we moved money from normal accounts over into these other accounts and generating lots of fees along the way for the bank. And they were sacking people. Well, firstly, the business leaders were hassling the people that were charged with like finding these accounts and opening them, ringing them up several times a day, like, how are you going, how many accounts, people staying late, trying to make sure they opened accounts, sacking people that weren't performing without, a lot of people sacked without really wondering why we're sacking all these people that they're not performing. And really there was a conduct issue, you know, maybe a bit of pushback or something like that. Because, you know, we're not alone in some of these things. And unfortunately, there's too many examples for me to put on one page, but here are two. Commonwealth Bank has agreed to refund 65,000 customers $10 million for selling them unsuitable consumer credit. Sorry, I think there's some online people. Unsuitable consumer credit insurance. So this is insurance that was sold to people about, temporary and permanent disability cover, things like that. These people did not qualify. Unemployed people and students, they did not qualify to claim on this insurance, yet this insurance was sold to them. QBE, a similar sort of issue with through car dealerships and some insurance that was sold there, 35,000 customers, and they're paying back about $16 million. They found that there's little gap between, you know, the value of their car and what their loan was, and so what was being covered wasn't really there. Duplicated existing cover, effectively more insurance than you would ever need, and some of these things have very low claim rates and really inappropriate. So we've set up a consumer credit working group to look at some of these issues. So there are industry and consumer representatives on that, and we're looking to perhaps some better practices in those areas. My area, we're not immune to that. We've got some issues in FX. I think you might find that five banks in Australia have enforceable undertakings arising from some of the behaviour and lack of systems and controls in that area. And also we've done a deep dive into research and capital raisings and found some issues where we're not, you know, just poor conduct and often driven by the dollar. So we've already done two conduct risk surveys, and firstly to investment banks a couple of years ago, looking at those issues. I won't go through each of those on the screen. Very much self-assessments. And so what we've found is that there is improvements in the processes out in the firms that we've surveyed. The most recent survey we've done included some stockbrokers. And so effectively what we've found is that the European and US, sorry, I was going to say parented, but the firms with US and European Union parents are well ahead in implementing some of these controls or controls in some of these areas than some of the Australian firms. And we might say, well, the Australian firms might be lagging. Well, I think my view is maybe that the driver behind those firms reviewing their conduct and culture have been those massive fines that they've been paying, and they were several years ago. So I think that, to their credit, all the firms that we're dealing with are implementing something that we're fairly happy with progress of in these areas. And of course, almost all respondents use those three lines of defence of business, I guess, independent controls and internal audit, followed at the back by APRA and ASIC, I guess, now. And so one indicator, there's lots of indicators that we find. I think it was really good that Farmy mentioned the one-on-ones, because the surveys are great and it does give people an idea of where they stand and where they might want to beef up their controls. But the one-on-ones and the meetings that we have with people give you a much better idea about how committed people are. And I've heard earlier that people, on one of the slides, I think, talking about employees and clients. Some of the firms we go to that I think more advanced, they're talking about community, they're talking about industry reputation, they're talking about vendors and how they treat vendors. It's not just, it's how you treat everyone, right? And those are the sorts of things we get more out of those one-on-one meetings. Now, we've also had a look at sound remuneration practices, which is I think this is one of the key areas. So this is a separate survey, and we borrowed types of controls from European Banking Authority, I think was most of it, but also from other regulators around the world, 70 different items, and we found that in the 17 investment banks that we looked at, 78% of those controls were in place, so that was pretty good. We fed that, so we've already done feedback statements to each of the firms for both these surveys so they could see where they stood amongst their peers on a self-assessment basis. So this is self-assessment. And so that's been pretty good. Most firms have recognised conduct risk as a separate, discrete risk outside of operational risk. One or two firms going, like, what are you talking about? This is just governance. It's just good governance. And effectively, they're right. But it is it's a culture of good governance, I expect. And so I think we're pretty well placed on both of those results. In terms of progress, right, I think it really is important that we have those lines of defence. But also, I think the answer to the question about how do I get the board's attention, well, if you can't get the board's attention, I think we have a problem at the board there, right? So that's something to consider. So we've also shared these results with APRA, and we're working more closely, I think, in this area than we have previously in the sort of operationally. And almost finally, I think, what are we doing? What else have we been doing? So we've done a review of mortgage broker remuneration that I think is worth reading. If you're interested in that area, I think you can see some of the things we're concerned about are that bonuses are usually driven by the supplier of the product rather than consumer paying for what they're getting. And then in the wholesale spot market, we've got, I guess, three areas. One is training about what's right and what's wrong. Like, I'm not joking. In this area, it would appear that there was some entrenched behaviours that really would be, in my world I'm really from, which is the equities and futures markets, just not what's going on over there. And so that's important, the training. The other thing is the remuneration is important again. And finally, the detection and deterrence. So having sound systems, some of the markets that the FIC markets, so fixed income commodities and currencies, they're very diverse, fragmented markets, and that is where this gatekeeper role is quite important, because we have beautiful information for the equity markets. For these markets, they're so fragmented, very hard to get good information. The firms themselves will have most of that information. So in this sense, that gatekeeper role is far more important. Moving on, next we're going to look at sale of direct life insurance and breach reporting practices, and effectively seeing whether firms' values are focusing on the right outcomes for consumers and the market. So I might pause there.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have 15 minutes allocated for questions, but depending on the level of interest, given this session, we may run a little bit into lunch, but I promise I won't keep you too long from your sandwiches and orange juice. I didn't say at the start of the session, media are present for this session, so hopefully we get some questions from there as well. Same deal as before, please wait for the microphone, please introduce yourself so that everyone in the room and on the webinar can hear your question or comment. So, any first takers? Leslie.
Thanks. My name is Leslie Traverso, so a question for Farmy, please. You were talking a little bit about getting more involved with knowing the risk professionals in the organisations that you're communicating with. Do you think that will extend in the future to being involved in the appointment of those individuals in the first place, like they do in some other jurisdictions?
If I understood your assertion correctly, you mentioned we're trying to get to understand risk professionals better in the organisation. What I would say is we know risk functions of financial institutions really well. Actually, what we're doing through these pilot reviews is getting well beyond the risk function and moving into the business lines a lot more to understand what's going on. But I think we've made it clear, and our chairman has said publicly a number of times, that when it comes to the appointment of people, such as, for instance, in the UK, where the PRA and the FCA jointly approve senior executives, senior managers under the SMR over there, we're not going to do that. And we've made a clear policy decision not to do that. We think accountability should rest squarely with the board on these issues. And we think that might get tangled up if, in fact, APRA starts playing a role in that space. But in saying that, I mean, clearly we have often frank conversations with boards and senior executives about certain executives perhaps that have come up from time to time in discussions. But We're keen to maintain a separation of accountability, and that's to rest with the board in terms of appointments.
Hi, Fahmy, it's Natasha Hall. Question for you, obviously. Interested in how large the set of survey questions is, because we see quite a variation across different consultancies and research organisations and universities. So interested as to the quantum of questions and the breakdown within that.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing a bit of trial and error with a number of different formats, but we have deployed questions of 50. It can be more, it can be less, depending on the situation. So we suspect where we'll end up is a model for different types of scenarios, depending on what that will take. So it varies, but certainly I would say 50 is a notional one to be thinking about in terms of the source of starting position for us.
Just a follow-up question and comment, I guess I completely agree that the interviews are the critical piece. The survey sort of gets you a lot of coverage across a number of employees and some high-level trends, but then the one-on-one interviews, which are confidential in nature, are really illuminating. So interested in, I guess, your approach within those sessions.
Yeah, look, it's one in which we're trying to foster a very open type of conversation. And so typically that will start off with just getting to know each other and trying to put them at ease, and certainly confidentiality is absolutely critical. We make it clear up front that it's not about the individual responses we're getting, but it's actually the totality of the information we're collecting. So if one person is absolutely anti that institution, but they're an outlier, that's not going to factor in terms of our overall position. If that's consistent across a number of different channels of data, that would be a concern to us. So we try and make that clear. We try and have a guided conversation around the sorts of things that are prioritised in an organisation. So we often utilise cards to be able to say, well, here are some risk behaviours. What would you think are the highest priority ones? It's this or this, what are the lower ones? That gives us a sense of where to go in the conversation and what they're thinking. That enables us to extract what we think is meaningful data to interpret and then put together with everything else we collect.
Okay, question over here.
G'day. Michael Rodden from the Australian newspaper. This one's just for Fahmy. How many companies are involved in the trial and when are you expecting to roll it out across the entire industry?
Sure. So five entities are part of the pilot, and we're covering insurance institutions, banking and superannuation as well. We're hoping to have finished our pilot reviews by the middle to September of next year, after which point we will start building this into BAU type of supervisory practice. This is brand new for us, and I should point out, we're one of the very few regulators in the world doing this. There's only one other prudential regulator doing what we're doing. So this is a lot of, this is very new to us, so we're taking a bit of time to make sure we're doing this in a way that makes sense to us. But hopefully come towards the end of next year, we will be able to talk to industry about how we've built this into normal business as usual type of practice. But a key point there is that to some extent you need some specialist capability to be able to do these sorts of things. So we've got that now within the team that I run, but there is a question mark that we've got in our minds as to what does that mean for your normal day-to-day supervisory process when perhaps that skill set may not be there. So they're the sorts of things we're thinking about in terms of tailoring and tweaking our models to different types of circumstances.
And sorry, just which other prudential regulator was that?
The Dutch Central Bank. So they've been doing this stuff for a number of years now, on the back of a parliamentary inquiry to the GFC, where they were told you need to look into culture a lot more. They have, and they've done some really important seminal work in terms of what regulators can do in this space. We've looked at that, and we feel we've built on that to make it something that makes sense from an APRA context.
Were they sending psychologists out to the meetings, the board meetings or something there, I think?
Yes, they were. So their strategy was they had a whole team of just organisational psychologists going out and doing things. What we've done is we've blended organisational psychologists with their traditional supervisory expertise and come up with a blended approach that we think makes sense from an APRA perspective. But nonetheless, they were really focused on informal drivers. What we're trying to do is think about informal drivers within the context of formal drivers. So that provides us hopefully a comprehensive picture.
So you won't be wheeling couches into our board meetings?
No.
Okay, I've got a question for Greg, just while we wait for the next one. You seem to be focused a lot on remuneration practices. is ASIC looking at restricting how much pay can be aligned with things such as revenue?
No, that's. I think we're more interested in what people are putting in place and actually looking at what some of the better practices are. And I think, you know, it becomes difficult for a regulator to start saying exactly what people should be doing when you're a principles-based regulator.
Yep.
And we're more about really bringing to people's attention what some of the better practices are, where you stand with your peers, and I guess maybe really being fairly blunt when we think there are bad practices in place.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions from the audience? It's in the front.
Thanks. The outcome of the risk culture analysis, what happens next? Where do the results get reported to, and what kind of response are you expecting, and from whom?
So for the pilot reviews, they are like a normal part of our supervisory process, which is we will go back to the institution and give them our findings in terms of a response. Whether that results in follow-up action from us, we will do that, but it's in the context of our existing supervisory framework. So for instance, when we go out and do an insurance risk review to an insurance company, that report goes to the board, and we expect them to take action. Same thing for a risk culture review, but it's a conversation between us and the institution and no further, and that'll continue. I should add, though, that, you know, as I said, this is new territory for us, and we issued an information paper last year. Our intention is, throughout the coming years, to continually provide updated papers in terms of what we're learning, what we're finding, so we can share that with industry. But it'll be, of course, on an anonymised basis, not institution-specific, but the trends, the good practices, perhaps the poor practices, that's our intention going forward.
Okay. Question at the back.
Hi. Paulina Duran from Reuters. I'm just wondering whether throughout these recent reviews on culture, whether you had concerns around anti-money laundering laws being a problem for the banks in general. I noticed you'd said that you're not commenting on a particular institution, but is this a red flag for you in the industry?
I'll talk hypothetically. AML would be one of a series of different areas you might consider when we think about scoping a review. So perhaps I should have spent a bit more time on this in terms of how we scope a review, and that is when we go and do a pilot review or any type of risk culture review, we don't go in and say we've reviewed the entire culture of the entire organisation. We think that's almost impossible to do. What we do is we focus on a specific area of an institution, and maybe just their sales area, and maybe just be a trading desk, and may just be a risk management area, it may just be the board. We think having a targeted focus enables us to provide hopefully a more comprehensive review on culture. For a very large institution which is made up of many subcultures, it's going to be impossible to deploy limited resources like APRA has to be able to understand that in one go. And so, for instance, if there was AML red flag for an institution, that might be a driver for us to perhaps target in that area of the institution and just focus a review down there. But we'd be taking into account all other perhaps red flags that might be of interest to us that we might then focus a pilot review around.
Yeah, I guess what I was asking is, before these allegations by Austrac, had you seen red flags based on the work that you've been doing since 2015?
Not specifically, but we've only really started deploying our risk culture methodology this year. So I'd say it's too early to be able to provide you with a comprehensive answer to that one.
I've got another question that's for both of you, but I might start with Greg. How closely are ASIC and APRA aligned on a lot of these issues around culture and conduct? We talked about different models before, and you know, some of the praises of Twin Peaks and how it's been adopted elsewhere.
So I guess as I mentioned earlier, the APRA and ASIC, our objectives are slightly different because we're different peaks, but ultimately it's about, you know, the market being fair and efficient and stable. And so we have been, we've got a secondee down with Farmy's team. We've swapped notes, we've shared our results of our surveys so they can see, I guess, get an indication of the people that completed the survey that are members of APRA, where they sit in the world. And so, but They are separate teams, but we do swap notes. And one thing, of course, we don't want to do is send out surveys the same at the same time, right? Or even closely behind. So, yeah, I think we're coordinated. I think we're pretty happy with how that's working.
Sure. Bobby, anything to add to that?
No, I'd simply add that, as Greg mentioned, different objectives, but also our supervisory approaches, just by the nature of our work, is different as well. We are, from an APRA perspective, for particularly large or very systemically important institutions, we are effectively almost on-site daily, talking to people on a regular basis. That's a different approach to perhaps ASIC, who's got many more institutions to deal with, and how they conduct their surveillance. It's a different approach which will require a different type of interaction. But we're trying to exchange notes as much as possible, so we're informing each other as we go forward.
Question over here.
Hi, Ranjan Suncorp. I just had a question around how you metricate something as complex a construct as culture and conduct, and whether there's any industry benchmarks that you apply there. You talked about qualitative and quantitative. I think the qualitative is probably easier to land on. And whether there are any domestic or international benchmarks, how you calibrate them for scale and complexity of organization, and whether there's any role models you can call out.
I'll tackle that one first. Look, from our perspective, we think this notion of measure really detracts from people understanding culture. And I think we all work, well, most of us, I imagine, work in financial services. We love data. We love to measure stuff. I like spreadsheets for sure. But when it comes to culture, it's incredibly hard. So actually, the way we talk about culture is that we think you can assess it. We don't think you can measure it, but you can assess it. And that what that means is you're taking into an array of information to land on a position that you think is an assessment, as opposed to saying, well, is this metric here, or it's this a red flag here. It's much more than that. And I think the sooner we can turn our minds away from measuring, the better it will be for everyone, because that unlocks us in terms of thinking about what are the possibilities in terms of culture and what are the full gamut of things to take into account, which is large, right? And so I think it's, for anyone who asks me, can you tell me your measure? I say there is no measure. We just assess it based on a whole variety of factors of data points.
Dangerous ground telling a room with a lot of actuaries about moving away from measurement, but fair point. I think it makes perfect sense. I've got a question over here from Vern.
Hey, I'm Vern Baker from KPMG. Just speaking from the CROs in the room, I was wondering if the regulators might be able to give CROs some tips on how to improve risk culture within the organisations.
Well, I think that the important thing is to have an understanding of where your people are sitting in the world, and are they thinking about these things? What controls? I think the measurement thing's important. It's about, like, if we give a list of 20 things, any of us can think of 20 things to measure, but then looking at effectively, well, what are the most appropriate things to have in place about remuneration? What's important? Do you have those in place? Are you thinking about what the controls you have in place do in terms of driving good behaviour? And the controls might be in place, but are they actually effective? Like, it's great having... I really don't like checklists, right? So, yes, we have that in place. It's really about, is what we're doing effective? That would be my tip, is what you're doing to manage your risk effective.
I'd add, maybe from a slightly different angle, is that what we've certainly learnt in Australia over the last couple of years within Australian financial services is that the CROs are very active in this space. That's great. I think what we also called out in the paper was that we're kind of at the early stages of and early days of really understanding culture and how that works within the financial services context. But what I'd also add there is that that's also a red flag to us, because our view is it's actually the business lines and the CEOs in particular who should be having the biggest type of dialogue around culture rather than the CRO. We see the risk function as being supportive and contributing to that dialogue, but actually, unless it's the CEO and the heads of the business lines actually driving that, you're not going to get risk being a part of the DNA of the organisation, which is what we need to see. There's this term that is often expressed called we have a generative state of risk culture. That means you think and breathe risk in terms of whatever you do. What that'll take is not just the risk function talking about risk, it takes everyone, right? And you get to the first, second, third lines. It's the first line that own the risk. They should understand the risk. And so we look for that in terms of institutions. So to what degree does the CEO, are they passionate about this topic? To what extent do the heads of the business lines really understand risk? That's a big flag for us, because no matter how effective the risk division is, it doesn't matter if the business line is not getting it.
And I just, in terms of training, so all the firms we talk to, about the big firms, they have training programs, culture, conduct training programs. Now, we think the online, that sort of program, well, that's okay. It's when the business people are delivering the training, the middle managers that, and the tone from the top thing again, the top people and the business managers delivering that training is much more important than an online course, and that's the sort of thing I'd be looking out for. There's not measurements. What are we doing? How committed are we?
Okay. I think we've got time for one more question just over here. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Fahmy and Greg. Thank you for your presentations. Gaurav Agrawal from EY. Fahmy, probably a question for you. You mentioned as part of the pilot, APRA will be doing in-situ board observation sessions. Having been on the APRA side of the fence, there's always the potential that management, for want of a better word, may rehearse, especially given the prudential regulators coming in for a review. So my question is, what are your views on potential challenges sitting in on the board sessions of running that risk, and also any learnings that you've had from pilot reviews that you've conducted to date or the Dutch regulator that might address that?
Thanks, Gaurav. It's actually nice to see a lot of ex-APRA alum dispersed across the audience today. So this is where the Dutch have conducted over 60 on-site reviews already, factoring in that approach. And the clear advice they've given to us is, at the end of the day, the business still has to make decisions. The board still have to make decisions. And so as much as they might want to practice whatever else, things are going to come out in the wash when it comes to making a decision on a strategic proposal, on a risk decision or something like that, which we'll get a sense of. But also bear in mind that in terms of our methodology, we're not relying on any one particular point. It's trying to get an array of data points that hopefully line up in terms of common themes. So if we find that, I don't know, they have rehearsed, the board has rehearsed a certain discussion and it doesn't align or to some other things we've seen, well, that's okay. We'll find some other things that might happen. But we think given the very wide footprint we will have on a risk culture review, it's going to be very hard for us to walk away from a rehearsed board meeting to go, that really stands out as unusual. It would stand out to us. But also given the fact that we'll also look to try and incorporate EXCO, executive committee meetings, observations of those sorts of nature, that'll give us another touch point in terms of, is that weird that happened or not? You know, so we'll certainly be attuned to it. There are clearly, I think a human reaction might be from a board perspective, we want to be on our best behaviour, and that's perfectly fine. But part of this review process also is very early engagement with boards, for instance. So typically 3 months before we're even on site, we're talking to boards about this is what it's going to look like, this is what it's going to take, this is what's expected of you in terms of when it comes to the review. So there's plenty of warning, plenty of preparation. We're as open as we can be when it comes to this review to say, just be how you feel you should be.
Thank you. I lied. I'm going to ask one more question, a quick one for Fahmy. Your governance, culture and remuneration team, just out of interest, how large is that team?
So the team is 9 and we're moving to 11 very shortly with an array of skill sets, organisational psychology, economists, frontline supervisors, operational risk specialists, governance specialists, remuneration specialists as well. What I didn't mention today is that we're doing a very specific piece of work on remuneration industry practices right now in Australia. It's the most in-depth review we've ever done actually. It's really giving a good sense of exactly how REM practices are playing out and how that's contributing to the culture of financial institutions across Australia. So, and hopefully we're looking to publish a paper towards the end of this year which will summarise our key findings from that. But that'll really complement, hopefully, our risk culture review methodology as well.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're out of time. So please join me in thanking Fahmy and Greg for a very insightful session.